Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Daniel Cooper, Vice Admiral, retired, former Undersecretary for Veterans Benefits, and a past authority in the military government business and policy. Now, Dan, you just got a remarkable history. Just amazing what you've done over your career. So thank you for coming in today and sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, I appreciate the chance to talk with you, Stephen.
Now, Dan, again, looking at your background, it is just remarkable. You're one of the, a historical figure for all that you've done. So initially, what inspired you to go to the Naval Academy, and what best practices stayed with you throughout your career?
Well, as far as going to the Naval Academy, I hadn't thought anything about anything that I was going to do when I was in fifth and sixth grade. However, my father joined the Navy, went in as an officer in late 43, and although he asked for destroyers, he was assigned to Washington since he had a law degree, and we moved to Washington, D.C. So while down there, a couple times every weekend we'd go somewhere, and a couple of times we went over to the Naval Academy, which sort of intrigued me. And I sort of started thinking about where I wanted to go to college. But then there was a graduate from the Naval Academy who had lived in our hometown in East Liverpool, Ohio, and he started to encourage me to think about the Academy to the point of sending me catalogs every year. And whenever he came back to Ohio, we returned to Ohio after the war. When he would come back to Ohio, we'd get together and have breakfast or lunch, and he'd just talk to me about what I was doing and what I was interested in. So that's the type of thing that encourages any young kid to think seriously about a career. So those are the primary reasons I went, and served me in very good stead. As far as best practices, or what I have retained or improved on as a result of my education at the Academy, first, I would say, obviously, a sense of patriotism. You can't go to the Academy without being instilled to a great extent by that particular patriotism. One of the things I learned very quickly was time management. At the Academy, unlike any other university, you don't have much time to mess around or do things other than what you are required to do. You're required to participate in some specific athletics, some extracurricular activities, and you're required to go to classes at a time. It's not a matter of skipping classes or deciding not to go today. And in the end, at the end of the day, at night, an alarm goes and you go to bed. And in the morning, the alarm goes and you get up. So it's regimented, but you learn very quickly. If you don't manage your time, you're going to fall behind. Another thing that I picked up relatively rapidly was how leadership was developed, because you were able to observe officers around the yard. That's what we call the campus at the Academy. But you observed officers, either they might be instructors or they might be in leadership positions. But you got to see different types of people working and sort of molded in your own mind what you thought about leadership, how you yourself were going to acclimate to it. And finally, the people that you meet at the Naval Academy. There's not a wide variety, as you can imagine, but they are very, very solid people. I would say to you that the average individual at the Naval Academy was a better than average athlete in high school and a better than average student. And so you have a relatively amenable group of people who are coming in interested in being in the Navy, and therefore you kind of look at them and see what they do, what you can learn from them.
You know, it's interesting. It sounds like you were able to model some of the leadership that you saw in the officers at the Naval Academy and in your instructors, and then also amongst your colleagues who were going through the program with you, who were sort of model citizens in essence and really sort of stellar performers. And I would imagine then some of those relationships you formed at the Naval Academy continued throughout your career.
Yes, I would say, and my wife has made this statement, that the interesting thing is how close many of the classmates remain throughout their career and beyond. And I think that's primarily because we all go into essentially the same profession, into the Navy profession. Many go into the Marine Corps. But because of your educational background and because of the type of thing you're doing in service to your country, We do remain relatively close, and even today, you go to alumni functions, you go to class functions, and the wives get to know each other very well. Pretty much unlike, I think, most civilian colleges, where once they graduate, they have a much greater tendency to scatter.
Now, Dan, you also spent some time at Harvard, so can you contrast that time at Harvard and what you learned?
Yes. First, you have to look at what is the purpose of each of those institutions. And the purpose of the Naval Academy is to develop officers who are going to pursue a military career, at least for a time, if not throughout their entire career. At Harvard, you are developing a much broader range of individual. And so once you get past the purpose, then I would say to you that the advantages of going to Harvard is your exposure to a much broader range of individual, both as a student and in the professors. You get a much broader range of thought. You're exposed to books and things that you don't have time to look at when you're at the academy. And so it is, as I say, a broadening of your education. I was extremely fortunate while I was at Harvard to have two events occur, which helped me to see how various institutions react. One of them was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And at that time, I was taking a course, both a course and a seminar from Henry Kissinger. Similarly, I was in a club that met frequently, and the day after it was made known we were in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was at that time a professor in Columbia, came up to talk to the group of which I was a member. So you got that kind of exposure and that kind of thinking. We also were up there during the time of the first election for Senator Kennedy from Massachusetts, and he was running against Cabot Lodge Jr. So just observing that particular political function, as Kennedy, of course, won, but we also got a group I was in, was able to interview Cabot Lodge Jr. after the campaign. So you're exposed to a lot of things in which you neither have the time nor inclination to be exposed while you're an undergraduate at the Naval Academy.
So at what point in your career, then, were you at Harvard? I imagine then you were a more senior officer.
No, I'd been at sea, I'd been in the Navy about 5 years at that time. When I left the Academy, I went to an amphibious ship, and I was on there, presumably after I was on there a year, I was going to be allowed to go to submarine school, but the commanding officer made me stay aboard another 6 months. So I'd gone into the amphibious force, then gone to submarine school, and then I'd been on a diesel submarine for 3 years. At that point, I requested to stay at sea another year, and the Bureau of Personnel sent me a letter and said, no, you're going to have to go to postgraduate school, and your choice is Stanford, American University, or Harvard. And I said, oh, darn, I guess I'll try for Harvard. And so I did and was able to get in. So I'd only been in 5 years, and this is about the time, historically, that we have given junior officers a chance to go to postgraduate school or some additional education.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. Now, as you mentioned, you became a submarine officer. So what did you learn while being a submarine officer?
Well, as I said, I had been on a diesel submarine for 3 years, so I understood submarining as such. As I was leaving Harvard, I received a message that said they would like me to come down to be interviewed by Admiral Rickover, who, of course, is the father of the nuclear Navy. I had called back to them and said, no, I think it's rather than, since I'm coming out of Harvard in a relatively soft course, then I ought to go to sea for a year and do sea things, do professional things at sea, and then go be interviewed by Rickover. I don't think he will be especially impressed by my having been at Harvard. I got a message back the next day saying, feel free to come down in 2 days to be interviewed by Admiral Rickover. So I went down and went through the rather excruciating series of interviews that Admiral Rickover gave for those who were going in the nuclear program and was accepted. So then for the next year, I was going through the very intense nuclear training, both class work for 6 months and then at a nuclear prototype. From there, then, I went into the nuclear submarine force. So my career was a progression from surface forces to submarines, diesel submarines, and then eventually to nuclear submarines. So through that then, and particularly through being exposed to the nuclear program and to Admiral Rickover with his very intense management style, I learned several things in depth that I had not thought about much before. And one is attention to detail. In the nuclear program, if nothing else, we give great attention to detail in ensuring we do things right. The second thing was attention to procedures. A lot of people feel that because we are so attentive to procedures, we do not allow deep and penetrating thought and to go off and do various things. We are very intense on nuclear safety. And so procedures are very important, and following them are very important. A third aspect, particularly to the nuclear submarine, is quality. You want to ensure everything that you do, every piece of equipment that goes in there, is of high quality. And you have to have technical knowledge. It's nice to be broadly educated in the wonderful ways of life, but if you're going to be in nuclear power and in submarines, you want to pay attention and have that technical knowledge to fall back on. Finally, I would say focus and teamwork. I always liked submarines because I identified it to the same as a football team. The sonarman on a submarine doesn't want to be an engineer. The engineer doesn't want to be the cook. The cook doesn't want to be the yeoman. All of them don't want to be the weaponeers, just like on a football team. The tackle doesn't want to be the quarterback. The quarterback doesn't want to be the halfback. But all of them have to work together and have a very specific knowledge of what they are expected to do, and therefore you run into teamwork. And that is what I really like about working in submarines.
You know, you stated that you had this really interesting interview, and perhaps it was quite challenging. What made it so, hard in essence?
You mean the interview?
Yes, the initial interview to get into the submarine.
First, you've heard of everybody having different interviews and having different experiences. You know that Admiral Rickover is a very hard-nosed, dedicated, intense individual whose primary purpose was to ensure that we had a successful nuclear power program in the Navy. And when he started, everyone thought he was going to fail, so no one paid much attention to him. But, as you know, he was very successful. In that regard, then, one of his methods of success is ensuring he interviewed every single officer, whoever came into the program. And so it could be an intense interview. And he would ask you questions with which you were very uncomfortable. For instance, why didn't I do better at the Naval Academy? And I guess I'd stood in the upper quarter of the Naval Academy, but why didn't I stand number one or number two? Interestingly, Jimmy Carter was interviewed by Rickover. Jimmy Carter, who stood very high in his class at the Naval Academy, he later wrote a book, Why Not Number One? Because Rickover pushed him hard as why didn't he do better than he had. So it was an intense interview. You knew that probably at some point he was going to yell at you. And in fact, in my case, he kicked me out two or three times because he did not like the specific answers I gave him. Finally, we agreed on the correct answer, and I was accepted into the program. So it was the expectation of the interview, and then going into the interview, having some of those expectations met, and then going back in, and finally being accepted. But it's one of those things that you're always concerned that Rickover is going to look closely and wonder what in the world you did and why you did that. But the interviews were a major part of the program. He would look at your entire record, then he would look at the interview, and then decide if he was going to take you into the program.
You know, that would, I guess, make then the submarine, at least at that time, just in a way the elite, because of this intense kind of scrutiny that you were under, and because it was controversial, you know, in terms of, you know, will these nuclear sort of submarine system work or not? So I could see why those filters were applied, but it would also mean, though, that if you made it through those filters, you were a special person.
Modestly speaking, we think we are a special force. I tell people, the submariners, we may be the silent service, but we are not the modest service. But the fact is, because of Rick Oer's intensity in selecting people, in having oversight of the manufacturing processes for the nuclear power program, for every single aspect of the nuclear power program, he had control. As a result, we have never had a nuclear accident within the submarine force. We have lost two nuclear submarines, the Thresher and the Scorpion, but neither one as a result of a nuclear problem, nor has any radiation been released by those two ships that are on the bottom of the ocean.
So now you're transitioning from a junior to a senior officer. So what kind of qualities are required to make that leap?
Well, the first quality, obviously, is experience. There's nothing that beats experience. As an example, when I was commanding officer of my submarine, I had some really sharp junior officers. But I told them, you know all about the things that make up nuclear power. You can talk in great depth about nuclear power, about how it works, about how the machinery works. But I know by experience when to turn to port and when to turn to starboard. So any time that you come to a major decision, feel free to come to me and use my experience to help make the right decision. So the point is that experience is vital as you get more senior. The next thing is understanding people, because you have really good people, both enlisted and officer, on my submarine. Again, of the 100 or so enlisted I had, at least 8 of them had already gone to college, and a couple graduated, and yet decided to come into the Navy as enlisted personnel. When I looked at the record, 95% of those enlisted individuals could have, and some did, go on to college after they got out. So I would say that the understanding those people is vital. Maturity, you know, some people may grow older, but that does not mean that they grow more mature. The next thing is the in-depth knowledge, and finally, the importance of ongoing study and ensuring you never allow yourself to say, well, I know all there is to know or enough to get by, but to try to continue to learn what's going on and how things operate.
In your opinion, then, what is the sort of the percentage that reach the kind of positions that you've been able to attain in the Navy?
I'm not sure. My guess, if you start at ground zero, if you start going in as a plebe, and those who end up in the higher ranks, my guess is 5 to 7%.
Again, and then being in the nuclear submarine portion would even make it make you even more elite in many ways, because of just the all the filters and the challenges that you're put under. Now, as a naval officer, what were your 5 top challenges when ashore?
The challenges ashore are much different. And some people, after having command at sea, when they come to the Pentagon or to Washington, D.C., they have difficulty acclimating because everybody is not standing around ready to answer their every order. Matter of fact, they may only have 1 or 2 people working for them, even though they've had the august position of command at sea. And some people get into the thought process that command at sea is the greatest thing, and it is. It's the greatest thing you can do, but if you're going to work at the higher echelons in the Navy, you have to understand a lot more than just running a ship. You have to understand all the ramifications of the actions taken in Washington by everybody. So it's an educational type thing. You have to understand how the process works, and for the first of it, you have to understand that you don't know much, and so it's best to keep your mouth shut and just keep your ears open and move from place to place until finally you understand who the players are, what their positions are, what they're trying to do, how to get from here to there, that sort of thing. So first, I would say to you, is understanding the bigger picture. The next thing I would say to you is many people are uncomfortable with the budgeting process. Shortly after I went to Washington the first time, I decided if you're going to really do well in Washington or do your job, you have to understand the budget. So I worked pretty hard to try to understand the budget without getting more education, just trying to figure out what was happening on my own. So that was a challenge. Another challenge is understanding the process, not only of a big organization, but the process in Washington, D.C., which has many organizations which interact, not only the services with DOD, but also with Congress on the Hill and with various and other agencies around Washington, D.C. And the final challenge, and I've never had much problem with this, but a lot of people have a great challenge with frustration because they go in on a given day and they've said to themselves, I'm going to do this, this, and this. And at the end of the day, they may have done one half of the first this. And so as a result, they can become very frustrated and allow that frustration to eat at them and therefore have a very difficult time in Washington. And as they leave, they yell, I'll never come back. So those are the type of thing, challenges that you have. And by the way, if you go to Washington as a more senior officer, then you have to do everything you can to ensure the junior officers in and around you do not get the same type of frustration. But in fact, you have to help them develop into understanding why things are done in a particular and peculiar way and what they might think about doing to change a little bit here and there.
So during your stay in Washington as a naval officer, did you interact with some of the other armed forces senior officers?
Not on the junior officer level, no. As I got more senior, yes. Particularly at some point during my career, I was the budget officer for the Navy. And in that regard, then I operated quite closely with the budget officers of the other services, as well as the controller in Department of Defense.
And I guess during your career then, did you get to meet sort of other fabled military officers like Colin Powell and so on?
Meet them, yes, and may occasionally have something to do with them. In fact, I have a picture of sitting with Colin Powell at the Arlington Cemetery during one of the cemeteries over there, one of the ceremonies over there. But you work with them to an extent, but working in the submarine community, of course, there's nothing like the submarine community. No other service has anything quite like that. When I got more senior and was working on the strategic leg, in which you have the air, the missile, you also have the aircraft as two legs, and finally the third leg is the ballistic missile submarine. In that regard, yes, I worked fairly closely, particularly with the Air Force.
Now, what then led to your work with Veterans Affairs?
One day, well, first, I had been on the board for USAA, United Services Automobile Association, and I had left the board, and about a year later, I'm up in Pennsylvania, and I get a phone call, and the phone call is from the executive assistant to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and the executive assistant said to me, would I like to come to Washington and have lunch with Secretary Principe? Well, I didn't know Secretary Principe, although, by the way, he did graduate from the Naval Academy after I had. And I said, sure, I'd like to come down. And there were only five of us in that lunch. It turns out that Bob Harries, who was chairman of USAA, had recommended me to Secretary Principe. And so I went down to lunch, and there were five of us at lunch, and he asked me to do a study on the disability system. And so I said, first, I don't know anything about it. He said, don't worry about that. I just want someone to lead the study because I will give you 10 people, all of whom are very knowledgeable in the system. So I said, well, that sounds intriguing, and yeah, I'd like to do that. So, and this, by the way, started prior to 9/11, and so I was down there on 9/11, as a matter of fact, still doing my study, just completing it, and I completed it about a month later. Or I should say we completed it about a month later and reported out to the secretary. After we had done that, he said to me, matter of fact, while we were doing the study, I would go up and see him every morning almost. Both of us would get in about 6:30 in the morning, and I would go up and talk to him about what we were doing in the study and some thoughts we had, and I could tell by his reaction if he thought that was a good idea or a bad idea, but it sort of gave me some indication how to weave through this. And finally, fairly early into the program, about a month into the study, he said to me, would I be interested in being the undersecretary? I said, no. I said, I like what I'm doing. I like doing studies. I like having the freedom to go around and do other things, and I'm really not interested in a full-time job. Well, then, after I completed the study, he asked me again. And I said, no, I'm really, really not interested. Well, then, he set up a board to select, the previous undersecretary left, and he set up a board and asked if I would at least sit on the board. So I sat on the board to select a new one. We selected three people, and he didn't like any one of the three. And so finally, he said to me, look, he said, I really got to have somebody in there that I think is knowledgeable, somebody to do the job. Would you please take the job? And meanwhile, I'm living up in Pennsylvania. I'm staying down there during the week. I came home, talked to my, and I finally decided that at this point in my career, or in my life, that this was a pretty idealistic thing to do, and that there really was nothing else better to do, and I had just done a study into the major problem they had with the job itself, and therefore, I really should take it. And so, that's how I made the decision to take the job.
Now, I guess, just for the benefit of the audience, this is after you had retired from the Navy, right? After
yes.
Something
like, yeah. It's about 10 years later.
So you have this, what, 36, 37-year career with the Navy?
Counting the Academy, 37, yes.
And then 10 years after that, you're presented with this challenge and really perhaps an opportunity where you can have some impact. And it's remarkable that you took this opportunity or challenge. So talking about this Veteran Affairs position, can you share some of the most memorable experiences?
Sure. Probably the one I think about most of the time, besides working with all the people and visiting the many regional offices, one experience I had which was quite unusual, I thought, every year the Department of Veterans Affairs and the DAV, the Disabled American Veterans, get together and they sponsor something they call Winter Games out in Colorado. This is at the end of the skiing season, and they pay for about 30 to 40 veterans who have lost limbs, usually legs, maybe an arm, and they pay for them and a person or maybe a mother and father to come out with them, and they have facilities set up to teach them how to play hockey, going on a sled, to teach them how to ski downhill, sitting down and having two outriggers to guide them along. They take them horseback riding and other activities. And it was probably the most meaningful three-day period that I have spent while I was down there to observe what they were doing for these veterans, paraplegics, and how the veterans themselves were reacting to the very intense help that they got throughout this whole thing. And so I think that was one of the most meaningful things that I was able to do. A second thing that I'm struck with is meeting with officials from other countries. And I met with several different people at different times and sometimes a few of them together. And I began to realize that what this country does for its veterans is far and away more and better than any other country does. Each country has some kind of veterans benefits, but the United States is a much more extensive and in-depth assistance paid for by the government. Now, you read in the paper there are difficulties with various aspects of it, and when you're dealing with that many veterans, you can expect some difficulties. But overall, what the United States has done is far and away greater than any other country, and every other country recognizes this. Another memorable experience was the study itself, because I had these 10 people who were, in fact, experts, but each of them willing to listen to what people had to say. And we called in the various veteran service organizations to testify. and we called in various people outside the veterans organizations to try to understand what was able to be done in other communities, what were best practices, and that type of thing. So that's the study itself was very intriguing and encouraging. The chance to visit Walter Reed and visit with a few of the men coming back at that time from Afghanistan and to see them and talk to them was inspiring. And finally, another event I enjoyed was getting to go over to France. France, over the last several years, has done a lot to recognize veterans who came over and went and invaded Normandy and were in the Battle of the Bulge and went through France. And so there was a large ceremony they had as a result commemorating the landing in the south of France, well after the Normandy invasion. And I was able to go over and participate in that. So that was kind of a fun thing.
I guess on the other side then, you have this remarkable experience with Veteran Affairs. What would you say were your top challenges?
The top challenges had to do, again, with people, because I was coming into an organization that had, in my mind, been hit over the head very hard about they're not doing this, they're not doing that. And even today, you'll see the Department of Veterans Affairs takes hits for many things. And, you know, some of them they might be able to control, but many of them are things that are going to happen, and you just do your best to get through that. So one of the challenges was to get everybody focused on what we had to do to make improvement. And the study came up with 32 recommendations, of which 30 we implemented. Well, some of these changes were pretty drastic, and so now you have 57 separate offices around the country that you want to get focused into doing it your way, or the way that the committee, the study has decided, and the secretary has concurred, is the way that things should be done. And so getting them all focused and moving ahead is a challenging thing to do. And then as you do that, you want to ensure you're measuring quality and you're measuring the progress of all 57 in total. So that was another thing. Finally, I felt part of my job was to get between the detractors and my people. I had to protect my people from feeling beat up by the detractors. And so I would try to insert myself between the press and my people, between congressional activities and the people, let them know that I would give everybody the honest, straightest answer possible, but I did not want them to beat up my people, whom I felt were working very, very hard and trying to do the right thing for veterans. So I would say those were the primary challenges I had.
With all of the work that you've done then, you would have a sort of a good idea what makes an effective leader. And in fact, in this case, what would be required to be an effective government leader?
Well, to say that I understand might be less modest. I would take a different approach. But the fact is that I have strived and would recommend to anybody, they have to understand their people. They have to understand the people for whom they are working and the people who are working for them. And they have to respect those people. Unless for some reason an individual does something really stupid or something that's absolutely wrong, you have to give them the respect and the assistance they need to do the job right. So the first thing I would say, you have to understand your people above you and below you. You have to be willing to work hard or harder than anybody else so that you're one step ahead, so that you can see problems before they develop and therefore help divert from those problems. You have to have the technical knowledge of things and of process. You have to express and ensure people understand loyalty to those above you, so you don't undercut them. If they make a decision and you aren't particularly in agreement, you don't go out and say that's a stupid decision. You do your best to implement that decision, unless it's immoral. But if it's just a matter of not agreeing exactly how to do something, you do your best to implement that decision. The same thing with loyalty down. You want your people to follow you. Therefore, you have to try to understand what their needs are, what motivates them, and therefore do what is the correct thing. Another thing that a lot of people in leadership positions don't necessarily understand is being consistent. I talk about rules, having rules so that people understand they don't go outside the various boundaries. They can do all sorts of innovative things within the rules, but there have to be certain rules when you're running any kind of an organization. And your job as a leader is to ensure everybody understands what you consider the proper rules for that particular organization. And the final thing I'd say to you, you have to have a sense of humor. If you don't have a sense of humor, you have a very difficult time relating to anybody. And if you have a sense of humor, it can get you through some very difficult spots when other people might not have a sense of humor or understand what's going on. So I really think a sense of humor is an extremely important thing.
And it's kind of fascinating, I guess, especially in government, because there's just so many different forces playing out.
Yes, and there are also lots of peculiar and funny things that happen, too.
I can imagine. Now, you've also worked on boards. Can you maybe just give a short overview of your board history? That is, you know, boards of organizations and corporations, and then what useful lessons can you share from your past history of working on boards?
Well, the type of boards I've been on were a couple utility boards, submarine advisory boards. I was on a couple financial boards. One was Navy Federal Credit Union, and the second one was United Services Automobile Association. Both of them primarily military organizations, although both of them are very, very large in their field. So I got to observe them, and those last two had primarily militarily experienced officers. In the utility community, while you had maybe one or two military officers and the rest were civilians. And so the first thing I would say about boards is there are very few boards that do not have very smart, intelligent members who are expert in their particular field. That does not mean they're an expert across the board. That doesn't mean that every opinion they have is sacrosanct. But you have many smart people, so you want to make sure you play to their maximum advantage. You use their capabilities to the best advantage for the particular board and corporation. They also have varied backgrounds. So again, you have to understand what their background is, because sometimes that will help you understand the reason for whatever opinion they have or whatever ideas they might have. You also find that there are entities outside the board that can help you work. And particularly in the last 15 years, the term governance has become dominant. Governance, how do you run the board? I've been on a board that had almost zero governance because the CEO was absolutely in charge. Fortunately, I saw that same board then develop when that particular CEO moved on. Another CEO came in and started working the way boards should work. That is, everybody responsible for various aspects of boardsmanship and understanding there are rules, again, as to how a board should be run and what you do to do it properly. And so that outside help, there are specific organizations that help corporate directors. And so you want to stay involved with those organizations to find out what best practices are now being developed. You have to make sure that the board itself realizes that even though the CEO and maybe the CFO and maybe another member of the executive management group, they will be members of the board. But there are times that the independent members of the board, those who are not on a day-to-day basis associated with the particular company, that they meet separately once in a while to evaluate the CEO, to evaluate the CFO, to make sure that they're satisfied that things are working properly. Otherwise, you can have a CEO that may not be so good and is running the company off into left field somewhere. And so the independence of the, quote, independent directors is very important. Those are the types of lessons that I would give.
Now, you've had just a remarkable career in the Navy, and both in the submarine portion and but also ashore, working in many, many positions. And then beyond that, working within government and also serving with boards. From that perspective, then, you have an idea what constitutes great leadership. So can you share what you consider to be leadership lessons that could apply to corporate executives?
Well, again, I go back, I guess, two or three things. And one is, it just seems to me that idealism is a factor in success or your approach to life, that you have to have certain ideals. You always have goals, and that's fine, but you have to be idealistic. And it's difficult to a degree in today's society to remain idealistic when there are people who take everything to a very base level. So idealism is certainly one. Again, I can't overemphasize people. That you just have to understand people. It's whether they're at the high end or the low end. If they're laborers or if they're deep thinkers in a college or CEOs. Everybody is a people. Everybody has different ideologies. Everybody has different goals. Everybody comes from a different background. And those are the types of things that you have to understand, I think.
When you look back at your career then, what would you consider to be your top career successes and then lessons learned useful to the audience? And I guess there'll be some sort of overlap from what you discussed before.
Yeah. Well, everybody, as I said, is different. And so the primary thing that has helped me in everything has been my family. And my wife, who also comes from Ohio, as a matter of fact, we lived next door to each other for 15 years before I even took her on a date. And so the family and the fact that we were able to move around 26, 27 times, we have two daughters, and everything went well. And so if you're in the Navy and you're moving around, what can really be detrimental is to know that your family is disgruntled and dissatisfied because you've just moved somewhere and it's new and they don't know anybody. And so my wife and my family have been extremely supportive to the point of, as a matter of fact, both of our daughters married people in the sea service. One married a Coast Guard officer and one married a naval officer submariner. So that's one thing. Along that same line, we have six grandchildren, each of whom, two of them have gone to the Naval Academy, as a matter of fact, and the other four, one's in high school and the others are in college. But each of those have been ideal grandchildren. So that has helped me keep a focus on the type of work or whatever I'm doing and not have family problems. And I can't say more strongly how important that is. And not everybody is fortunate enough to do that. Next thing I would say to you, any success you have, as I think emphasized ad nauseum here, depends on the people you're with and the people that you've been able to work for who were willing to overlook some of your idiosyncrasies and the mistakes and say, hey, okay, you made a mistake. Let me show you what you should have done and then move on. The same thing with the type of people you had. I told you earlier that when I went to my submarine, I had five or six junior officers. I had a total of 13 officers in my crew. Of those 13 officers, counting myself, five of us made admiral. And that is a very unusual percentage within a war room. But that shows the type of junior officer that happened to, just by chance, come to my ship at the same time I did. And so that is something I feel very good about. And I feel, I think, very good about the work we did at the VA. A lot of that was due to the strong support I got from Secretary Principe. A lot of it was due to the good relations we had with Congress and the fact they were able to help us. And I very seldom got into any controversial position over in Congress. I must have testified 30 times while I was there. So we always had the support of Congress. And finally, I felt we had the strong support of a vast majority of those people in the VA because we had the idealistic goal of helping veterans. I'm not sure if I answered your question, so if you want to ask me that again, I'll be glad to try.
No, I think that's just a great answer, and I think it reflects all of the values that I see in you. And I'm not surprised that this sort of large portion of your junior officers became admirals or reached that level, but I think it also speaks to your leadership and your mentorship as well. So now, I know you've had this great career, but you also do a lot from a volunteer standpoint, and again, that speaks to just what a fine person you are. Can you talk about some of those most fulfilling activities on the volunteer basis and why they're so fulfilling?
Well, yeah, we've been fortunate to do a lot of things, but I'll tell you, interestingly, one of the activities that I've just gotten into in this retirement community where I am that I really feel good about is the last 2 years I have done an AARP Foundation tax program in which we go into the community and for low-income families, we will do their taxes free. And we then submit them electronically, and they'll get approved in a couple hours. And so we have helped, several hundred families get their taxes done, and most of them will get some kind of a rebate from their taxes. But that to me, and by the way, it's absolutely free. We don't get paid anything. We take training for 3 weeks before we start it each year, and then we go into the community, and we did it 3 times a week, I think it was. And that is about as fulfilling an extracurricular activity as any that I have done. Now, we've done others. My wife and I have done a lot of stuff with our church wherever we've been. An organization I'm involved with is called SCORE, and that's a nationwide organization. I think they have maybe 300-plus chapters around the country. And they take retired executives from businesses and try to help younger people who want to start a business. Now, I don't have a lot of experiences with running a business, but I am able to help them get good advice from other members of the SCORE chapter. And so this is around the country, quite an idealistic, I think, type thing to help people start businesses, and they are quite successful. Many businesses operate and start up within this community every year. Another group I'm involved with and have been involved with for the last 3 years is a very idealistic group called American Heroes First Foundation. It's run out of Texas. There are 5 of us on the board. Our goal, among other things, is to tie the average worker with the veteran and people in the service, and doing that by getting payroll deduction that we then accumulate. We have no specific programs ourselves, but we take this money and we get up to $25,000 or $30,000. We look at other veteran related organizations around the country and then look at specific programs they have which will help individual veterans, servicemen, and their families. We then sign a contract with that charity and say 100% of the money we give you will go directly to a veteran or serviceman in need in this particular program. So everything that we get in payroll deduction, 100% of that goes to the charity. 100% of that then goes to help specific veterans in a specific program. So that's another one of those very idealistic things that we're working hard on. I work a lot with Naval Academy applicants, kids. Somebody will come to me, and they have every year 2 or 3 people come to me and say, well, Johnny Smith wants to go to the Naval Academy. Would you interview him? And my answer always is, if Johnny Smith will call me, then he and I will decide where and how to do it. And so, of course, they always call, and then I take them to breakfast. And we sort of sit around and just talk about stuff and talk about the academy, and then a few months later, I'll call him and find out how he's doing and making sure he's making whatever progress is necessary. So that is encouraging because you see some really, really good kids who want to go to the Naval Academy or would like to have a naval career. 70 or 80% might get into the academy, but the others then go on and do well wherever they go. So that's really a kind of a fun thing. And then occasionally I get involved with committees down at the Naval Academy. And as I said earlier, both of us, my wife and I, do a lot with the church.
Now, you talked about your work in terms of maybe mentoring or advising prospective candidates who come and will talk to you, seeking your experience, and because you've got such a successful history in so many areas. What kind of qualities then, because we do have young people within the audience who will hear this, what kind of qualities make for a successful candidate? In other words, should they be doing very well in school, doing extracurricular activities? What are the kind of qualities would make an ideal candidate for the Naval Academy?
Well, the ideal candidate is one who is pretty well-rounded. That is, he's not necessarily an Einstein. He's not so intent on getting good grades that the rest of the world is going by. So I'm always interested in the extracurricular things, both within the school and within the community that they're doing. They do have to be able to be doing well academically, and I will always ask for the SAT score. Not that that is vital, but if in fact their SAT score is at least somewhere near the average of those going in, which is in excess of 1,200, not counting the new system, but the system they're going back to. But you don't want someone that's well below average, because then when they get the academy, they will miss the reason for being in a university. They'll miss the broad range of things to which you can be exposed, because they'll be head down all the time studying. So I look at that just to make sure they're somewhere within the range. But the extracurricular things that they're doing and the broad view of things that they have, I will ask them a few questions that have nothing to do with anything in particular, just to find out how broadly knowledgeable they are, and just talking to them and find out how they conduct themselves and how they answer questions, no matter what they are. And frankly, even part of it might be how they eat their breakfast.
Yeah, it's really, really, really interesting and just such a great overview. Now, you're still very active in many different activities, especially volunteer activities. You've already covered some of this, but in addition to what you already talked about, what do you hope to accomplish this year, and how will you measure your success?
Well, that's kind of a difficult subject, because being in a retirement community, I'm not absolutely focused on specific things for mankind. I am a member of something called the Residence Council here at Willow Valley, and so as a result, we'll be in charge of raising money for gifts that we give to the workers here. We have about 1,500 people, from lawn keepers to people in the dining areas, and so we try to raise extra money, as since you can't tip those kinds of people at Christmas time, we will then give them some of this extra money, or all the extra money that we raise. And so I'm in charge of that for our particular building. And that's pretty important. Of course, I'll be doing the income tax again next year. I'm still doing the score things. And I'm also trying to improve my golf and racquetball. But essentially just keeping my eyes open for things that for which I can volunteer and do on a case basis.
Now, Dan, we met at an event, sort of like a celebration of an anniversary of a remarkable company, and you were an invited, honored guest at this event, this QTC event. Can you profile the event and why you were there?
Well, one of the things that, in my last job at the VA, of course, was disability compensation. That was the major program we had. That took up 60% of my time. In order to evaluate a veteran for disability compensation, you have to have medical exams. There are more veterans than the capability we had within the Veterans Health Administration, which is the hospital administration for the VA, to do the exams. And so we had outside people that we contracted to do these physical exams. QTC was the primary company we used, and they had already been contracted by the time I went into the job, and they were there the entire 6 years that I was there. I got to know Steve Kay, who was the CEO at the time of QTC, and he would come in and see me, and we would talk, and I was extremely impressed by his intelligence and by the depth of knowledge, but more so by the attitude that he projected from his company. And then I was similarly impressed by the attitude of everybody whom I had met. During our conversations with Steve K. and myself, we discussed a person called Dr. K. And quite frankly, at first I had no idea who Dr. K. was. Finally, about the third time we got together, I realized that Dr. K. was not only his wife, but also was a superb physician and very knowledgeable individual who had developed several specific programs to help people administer these physical exams. And so when they did the physical exams for the disability compensation program at the VA, the people that were doing them specifically used the programs that Dr. K. had developed. So given that, now Dr. K. has resigned. I left the VA in 2008, so 4 or 5 years later. But the company has been sold, and Dr. K. last month resigned from her position. She's plenty old enough to resign. It wasn't a matter of just resigning very quickly, but the program is still going on very well. Anyway, this particular program to which we were invited was to honor Dr. K. And we were very pleased to be invited. They were very kind to allow me to talk for a couple minutes. But to finally, I had met Dr. K. a couple times, but to finally see her in action and to see the respect that everybody had for what she had done and for the type of person she was just really heartwarming. So we were very pleased to be there, and that's the reason we were there.
Now we're going to go to some, I guess, broader questions, and these questions may be difficult because they are so broad. But in your life, what surprises you?
Well, I guess in the big picture of things, people surprise me, and they surprise me with their ability to do things you do not expect. Their ability to succeed, their ability to adjust. I really felt on my submarine that I used to say, okay, go do this. And they would go back there, go wherever they had to go on the ship, and fix something of which I had no idea how to fix. So I'm constantly amazed at the talent people have and their ability to respond to responsibility, to respond to problems that develop, and to in fact solve the problem. So that is sort of a heartwarming type of thing that surprised me. A second thing that surprises me is the variety of opinion that you have across the country. Some of it intelligent, and after doing specific people doing studies and trying to understand why they have this opinion. Unfortunately, much of the opinion is based on bias, on background, with absolutely little in-depth understanding of the problem before the opinion is developed. So I'm amazed at the variety of opinion, and I'm amazed occasionally at how people express themselves with an opinion about which they know very little underneath the first sentence. The next thing that is surprising is the vast improvement changes we have made in computers, in iPhones, which gets to the real thing of the speed of information. The fact that today somebody in Ukraine can say three sentences and I may know that within the next hour. And that type of thing, of course, exacerbates the problem with trying to develop a way to solve problems in Congress. The fact that you have everybody expressing an opinion frequently with lack of knowledge, and once that opinion is expressed, it's out there. And then other people feel they have to refute that opinion, or they have to jump up and down and strongly support it again with not much of a foundation. So that is something that is surprising and something that we have to overcome. I'm surprised by the fact that our government has gotten away from where we used to be, where you had across the spectrum of politics, no matter how you use the term politics, but across the spectrum, you would have people on the far left and people on the far right, and then you would have two groups, one middle left and middle right. And it's those middle two groups that then would find the means to weave their way through whatever difficult problem arose. And I'm afraid today we have decreased the number of those people in the middle and increased those on either end, so we're now into a barbell effect. and we're not being able to get through some of this stuff as well as we should. And the final thing that surprised me across the world is really man's inhumanity to man. The fact that there are many people out there who can do harm and do so, even in our community in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Each day you read of things that people have done that you can't believe. And back in East Liverpool, Ohio, where I am from, why, I never was aware of the type of stuff that is done or the degree in which some of these actions have become prevalent across the country. So those are the things that kind of surprised me over the last few years.
Now, I was going to ask you what you will do next, but I guess you've done so much. So next is just continuing on and this wonderful life contribution and volunteering. Do you have any added thoughts to that?
No. If different things come along and I have a chance to participate or to help improve things or just to do menial thing necessary to make something a little better, then that's what I'd like to do. As I said, also, I didn't play much golf over the first 70 years, and I just thought that'd be cool to take that up. And I've tried the last couple of years, and I play at golf. I like to play racquetball, and so in my real spare time, I do that. But other than that, it's activities here and around Willow Valley, and occasionally we're within 2 hours of Annapolis, so we get down there a couple times a month to lectures, and I'm on a couple committees down there. And we have lots of friends in Washington. That's about 2.25 hours away, so we get over there. So rather than having a pointed activity, except this tax and the score that I talked about, it's just a matter of adjusting to what might be there and taking up new stuff and enjoying myself and my family.
Dan, you've got a storied career. You've done a tremendous amount through your naval contributions, through your post-naval contributions, working with government, and then working on boards, and your volunteer work, and so much more. And you've traveled extensively. You've met some of the most notable people in the world, and you've been able to mentor so many throughout the world. Through all of that journey that you've taken in your speaking travels and work, do you have any stories you want to share? Maybe something that was particularly amusing or surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
There are probably a couple of things that are kind of fun. One thing that happened, I talked to you about people adjusting. When I was on my submarine, we were in the Pacific, and we had been away from our home port for 6 months. We had been out on the Western Pacific. And so we came into Subic Bay, the Philippines, and we were going to be there for 3 days, and then we were going back to Pearl. So we'd put out the word, everybody shave all those beards you've grown and get a haircut and clean up your uniforms. So we go into Pearl, we look good, and we'll get underway in 3 days. And I said, by the way, on day two, we're going to have an inspection. We're going to have a big inspection out here on the pier. And then we'll go back to Pearl Harbor. So I had gotten some word right after I'd gotten into port, and I waited till after we had had the inspection. And then I called them all together, and I stood up one of those big bollards that you have that hold the lines from cruise ships when they come into port. So I stood up on the bollard, gathered everybody around me, and I said, okay, now, got a bit of news here. We're not going to be going back to Pearl Harbor. And in fact, we've just gotten special orders from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and we're going to turn around, and instead of going east to Pearl, we're going west, and we're going out somewhere over there. And when we get underway, I'll tell you. I don't want anybody calling their wives. My wife and the executive officer's wife will call them after we get underway tomorrow, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what we're going to do then. And now you have 24 hours to gripe. You can gripe up a storm and yell and scream, but after 24 hours, I don't want to hear anything more about it. And so then we dismissed everybody, and I never heard a gripe at all. It was really fun to hear the guys talking about, okay, well, this is what we got to do. That's the reason we're out here and that sort of thing. So that was kind of a fun thing that happened to me at one point. A second thing that happened one day, I was down at the VA. And I've told you all about Rickover, so that's what leads into the story. I was down at the VA, and the secretary called me and said, Dan, Prince Charles and Camilla are going to be visiting the World War II Memorial. Would you go down there and represent the Department of Veterans Affairs? And I said, sure. And, of course, I wasn't in uniform. I was a civilian. So I went down there, and there were four people from various departments there. Obviously, Prince Charles knew who the four were and had some kind of information, because when he came to me, he said, well, I'm glad to see the Navy's represented. And I said, yes, sir. So he then walked around. I don't know if you've ever been to the World War II Memorial, but he walked around the pool and went over to the side where there were several United States veterans who had been in London in World War II. And he talked to them for a while. And then he came, and he's about to go to his car. He turns around, and he comes back to me. And he said, did you work for Admiral Rickover? And I said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, well, how was he? And I said, well, he was very dedicated. He was very intense. He was very interested in doing everything right. But I'd never take him home to mother. And he laughed and turned to Camilla and said, just like Monty. So that was certainly an unusual response. And the third time, the third thing was there were two senators from a state here in the United States, two well-known senators, I might add. And after I had testified one day before the Senate VA committee, one of them asked me to, in the next couple of weeks, come to his office so he and I could talk one-on-one. He felt that we were not doing particularly well by the veterans in his state. And, in fact, we were doing as well there as we were anywhere. We were having problems across the board. And so I went and talked to him, and he had me come back. And at the end, I tell people, I thought we were sort of on a first-name basis. I called him Senator, and he called me Admiral. But next time I went before the Senate VA committee, he came in late, and I'm testifying. And after a while, he raised his hand, and he says, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask General Cooper a question. So at that point, I knew I better not stay around. It was time for me to leave the VA. So those are a couple stories that kind of stick in my mind of something unusual.
Those are great stories, and I know the audience would just love them. Now, we're down to our last question, Dan, and I sort of turned the tables here. So I'm saying, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I suppose I would ask something like, how do you view our country and our democracy today? And, I still have this high idealism, so I feel very strongly that we have the best country in the world, and I get very discouraged with those who denigrate it. But we also are exposed to vastly changing technologies and intelligence, as I mentioned earlier, and we just have to work through that. The fact is, every period, every era of our country, they've had vast change, and they've accommodated it, they've climated to that particular change, and now we're just moving on, and we have the intelligence to absorb what's happening now and move on. But it makes it difficult, and sometimes all of us don't climate very well, but I think that presents us with real difficulties and something we have to work on. I'm concerned about, in talking about our country and our democracy, I'm concerned about this point that I alluded to earlier, that we're more divisive, that we're less cooperative. We should, at least the way it comes to us in the press. Is the press bad? No. I think you have to have the press. I call it, rather with some deprecation, the great American free press. But the fact is that many of them are very good, and many of them try to put it out the best they can without opinion. A lot of people put opinion out as fact. But across the country, with the political situation we have, we're very divisive. Do I have a thought of how to improve it? No way. I don't. The system will just have to continue to regurgitate, regenerate, and eventually we'll get there. But that's the thing that really concerns me. Another question I might ask is, how would you characterize your life? And I'm back to the same terms I've already been using, that it's really one based on pretty much idealism. And when you asked me early on why I went to Naval Academy, well, because I had a dad who went into the Navy and who was very idealistic. And so I've tried to maintain that idealism, and of course, I've been accused along the way of being overly optimistic. I've had a few, including my mother, who occasionally claimed that I had too much idealism, too optimistic to get my feet on the ground. But, you know, so be it. But that's still a fact. And then another question I suppose I'd ask is, what's given you the most pride from your various endeavors? And as I stated earlier, my wife and the children and grandchildren and the whole family, we've never had problem number one. And so that's really what life's all about. All these other things are great, but there's a lot of good fortune. And as I said, I've had a lot of super people working for me, and I've had leaders who were able to overlook a few of the problems that I had or had developed. So those may be your three questions I might ask. Not necessarily they're particularly interesting, but I just thought I might ask them.
You know, earlier you talked about it's good to have a sense of humor, and I saw some of that when we talked a few weeks ago when you introduced me to your wife again. I mean, we sat at the same table the night before, and you reintroduced me to your wife, I should say, and I think you indicated something like when you first met her, you were twice her age.
Right. Yes, I was 4 and she was 2.
I just thought that was just such a, quite funny, you know, the way you sort of presented it, it was just, it just spoke to you as just this remarkable person with a great sense of humor. So, Dan, you know, I really shared so much during this interview, and we are indeed fortunate to have you come in. So thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you for the chance to do it, and I enjoyed talking to you, Stephen. Good luck to you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Daniel Cooper, Vice Admiral, now retired, former Undersecretary for Veteran Benefits, and a top military government business and policy authority.